Howdy, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, are James Jones.
Yep.
Nice job hosting last week, James. Thank you for doing that. And, of course, we have John Lindemann.
This is four in a row, Johnny. The streak remains unbroken.
This is the apocalypse.
And, of course, Guillaume Veillette.
That's me.
Hey, guys. Well, it's good to be back after a week off last week. I had some family in town. We did get to play some games and had a good time. Didn't play enough of anything to really make it worthwhile talking about here. But we got in some Mario 3D World and tried Spin the Bottle. But my sister wasn't really into it, and it's you need at least three people really to play that. So she got bored of it really quickly, and I was interested. I could have kept going, but we ended up only playing it for like 5 minutes. But I did play through a lot of other games too. So I have a lot of new business. So I'm going to try to go through it relatively quickly. I guess the one thing I wanted to talk about the most is, Yumi's Odd Odyssey, because I know you guys kind of intentionally skipped it last week. Cause Guy, you said you hadn't played much more of it. Have you by now? Have you given it?
No, I just, I've been playing my 3DS mostly in public transportation and the subway here. The train is really, really, not rickety, but, let's just say if you don't hold down to something, you'll fall. And there's not a lot of seated places. So it's not recommended. I play mostly, Ace Attorney and stuff like that, where you don't need to
focus. Sure. Okay. So you do play your 3DS. You just want something that's not too sensitive.
Yeah. Not too actiony.
That actually is very telling of Yumi, because this game is brutally difficult. I don't think it's broken. I don't think it's non-deterministic or anything like that. I think the physics are hard to get a handle on, and it took me about probably 3 hours of playing before I really felt like I was developing the skill for it. And at that point, the things that I'd been trying to do started to work enough that I could actually proceed through the game. I mean, I was stuck very much like James was that first time that we talked about it, with the first 9 levels. And I knew where the secret exits were. I just couldn't get to them because I didn't have the right skills. I just didn't really have the feel for it, where to put the grappling hook, when to hit the buttons. It's complicated. I mean, it really is. And it's a little different every time, just because the hitboxes are so fine that there's just 1,000 places that your little hook could attach to. It's not like tiles or anything like that. So the physics feel a little bit like the arc of your swings and things like that feel different every time you play the level, because you're never going to hit the hook in exactly the same place again. And that really makes it more of watching the way that she's moving rather than like memorizing exact button sequences or perfect timing. Like, you can't really memorize the timing in this game. You have to learn to work with the physics. Whatever happens anytime you get into a swinging situation, which is like 80% of the time, you just kind of have to have a feel for what to do every time.
Yeah, you have to get a feel for what you're doing. That's the way I would put it. And over time, you also develop little techniques, you know, like you realize, okay, there's... The thing is, like, it's not as easy as it sounds to just, like, swing from place to place. Like, she's not Spider-Man, right? She's got one hook. One hook, and it kind of takes a while to reel it in. So you have to know exactly when to let go and when to try to hook again, like, to do a continuous swinging motion.
Yes. So I think that was one of the toughest things for me, was to get used to the amount of time it takes for the hook to go out from you and also to come back in after you let go, before you can shoot it back out again. Mm-hmm. So any move, like you said, where you have to basically make 2 attach points in a row in midair is really tough, because you have to make sure that you get that thing out early enough that you don't fall down.
Right. So there's that
took a long time to get used to, for sure.
And eventually you realize, okay, just pressing left and right to try to swing doesn't really work. You kind of have to play with the length of the rope as well. And that's the only way that, like, basically kind of reeling in and then jumping is the only way that you can get any real momentum at this game. So as long as you don't master that, you're not getting very far.
It's really difficult to learn to do. And it really did take me 2 or 3 hours, which is, I would say, a very, very long learning curve before you really feel like you know what you're doing in a game. It's just a feeling I haven't had in a while. But I will say that I love that there's a 2D platformer that makes me think about angular momentum and elasticity and, you know, all these things. It's just, it's so strange. It's not strange because of the dumb fish people walking around or the trippy backgrounds, and none of that stuff really does anything for me, but it's just weird to play a platformer that is so physics based in such a complex fashion. I don't love it, but I'm totally fascinated by it, and I keep coming back to it. It's like what John said a few weeks ago about Steel Diver. It's strangely addictive, I would say. And now that I'm not as sort of roadblocked as I was for the first couple hours, I do actually make progress on a regular basis, even though it's still really, really tough going. That is keeping me going, and I've played quite a bit of it at this point. So I don't think I'm as good as Guillaume, because it sounds like you picked it up a little faster than I did. But now that I'm in the groove, I feel like, okay, this is a long hike, but I can do it. You know, I just, it's fun.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's not like I play a lot of games where you have this kind of mechanic, but I've played less
than...
There
aren't any.
Yeah. And I've played less than 3 hours, and I made it, you know, basically straight to the level 49. That means playing through about 20 levels. So I still have a lot to unlock, and I still have a lot to see. But basically, yeah, I made it straight to level 49, which I think is a boss, and that was kind of a brick wall. Also, it was like, what, like 2 in the morning when I stopped playing. So I was like...
Yeah, the bosses, I think, are extremely difficult.
Yeah, so I was not ready to face it, and then I went to bed, and I haven't played it basically since the day it came out, so I need to get on that. But
But you were making really good progress based.
Yeah,
on,
it was,
I mean,
it was kind of comical
experience.
Because that was just after James was saying this game is shit and impossible, like the controls are impossible, and I was just like, okay, update. I'm in level 27 now.
Yeah, face. That was really, really funny. But James, I'm curious, have you just completely given up on it, or?
I played it a bit more and decided that, no, I do think the controls in this game aren't quite right, and I just don't like it. So I'm done with
it.
Yeah,
I mean, don't torture yourself. You know, sometimes...
I mean, I gave it about 4 hours to try to get through one of those two, and I couldn't.
Right.
And I feel like that's pretty shit game design, if it takes 4 hours to try to get through those. Like, I don't feel like that game does enough to teach you how to get to those things.
Oh, I completely agree. I think... Yes, I agree. There are there's kind of a tutorial that you go through in the first couple stages, but they teach you a bunch of useless stuff, and the game never really teaches you the very important stuff about how to climb walls and things like that with your grappling hook, which early on is needed to get to a secret exit. Later on is needed just to complete the level. You know, it's a very basic skill, and they don't teach you that at all. And I think it's really fascinating to kind of the game attempts to teach you these things sort of organically, but it, I think, fails. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I basically had to teach myself a lot of these things about the controls. And so I feel a lot of satisfaction about that. And it makes me, I feel like I have a pretty deep understanding of the way that the game plays because I didn't take anything for granted. Cause in the very beginning, like I could even barely do the things the tutorial was trying to get me to do, like throw the hook up here to climb this ledge that you see in front of you. And it basically even says something on the screen like, just pull yourself up. And I still couldn't get it to work. I spent like 10 minutes in this tutorial level thinking, how stupid am I? It's just the game controls so very differently than anything else I've played. So I don't begrudge anybody for not having the patience for it. But it's to me, it has been rewarding.
I think that the problem that I had with it is that it painfully teaches you things that it really doesn't need to.
Right.
And then basically goes, fuck you, you're on your own.
I think that I've actually played a game with these rope physics before. I just remember. This reminds me of Worms Armageddon, when you use the rope. And you have to do the same kind of wiggling about, like with the up and down keys, just to, you know, play with the length of the rope to try to get anywhere. So, yeah, I guess I have played with these physics before. So that's probably what helped me.
I remember never really getting a handle on it in the Worms games, but it's also an item that I didn't have very often, so I never used it much. I was never forced to. You have so many other options in that game. In Yumi's Odd Odyssey, it's tough because they really force you to grapple with this mechanic because it is the only way to get around. I mean, her jumping is almost useless. So if you don't really master using this weird-ass elastic grappling hook, you can't play the game. There is nothing else. And that's part of why it's so brutal. But like I said, I have found myself very slowly coming to like it quite a bit. But it's not for everybody, to say the least.
Well, Worms has a rope tutorial, so go play that and then try Yumi's Odyssey. And the tutorial doesn't come with the game.
So, no, it doesn't. Another game that I've been playing, I want to talk about because it's sort of relevant this week. The HD remaster, whatever they're calling it, version of Batman Arkham Blackgate is out on Wii U now. I think they did finally put it in the press release, but it came out between normal eShop Thursdays. So it was out and then people weren't talking about it. And then someone asked Armature, I think Neil did. And they said, we think it's coming out this week, but they didn't sound very sure about it. And then I looked at the eShop the next day. Because I'd heard about the Wonderful 101 going on sale. So I went to go buy that. I haven't played it yet. And I saw that Batman was already up, and I hadn't even heard an announcement or heard anyone talking about it. So anyway, it was like a weird stealth midweek release.
The eShop is often unofficially updated on Tuesdays, it's a calendar for regular retail releases, right? So
anyway, I don't have the Wii U version. I don't really know anything about it, except I did read that they redid the map. But I haven't looked into it enough to see what they did to it. And a lot of people do complain about the map in this game, but honestly, I don't think it's nearly as bad as you might think. It's usable. It reminds me of the map in Fez. It's like not very clear at all how to read it, but once you figure it out, it's fairly useful. You can make it work for you. You can make it do what you want a map to do. So it's not that bad. It's not like it's just completely useless. But anyway, I mean, this is the 2D, 2.5D Batman game from Armature, which is made up of three former Retro Studios guys, along with a lot of other people at this point. They're kind of a small to mid-sized studio, I think. But this is their first time doing a Batman game. It was the first handheld Batman game from Warner Brothers in the past few years. And it was an attempt to bring the Batman Arkham series that's become very popular on consoles and is continuing into 2D and put it on handheld. So it came out on 3DS and Vita. And I got it over Christmas, played a little bit, and then put it down for a while. And then I picked it back up because I knew the console remake version was coming out. And I kind of wanted to get back to it. It like was like, oh yeah, I liked that game. I just never finished it. So I've played a lot more of it this week. And I want to talk about it on the show. I think it's a really good game. It is not really quite what I was expecting. I mean, being from the Metroid Prime guys and being very much a 2D game, I was really kind of hoping for something that would be more reminiscent of Metroid, and it's not that. It is much more a Batman game. So if you really, really, really love the Batman games on console, you're going to like this a lot because it is pretty slavishly faithful to that, except that Batman walks on a 2D plane. Like, in every other way, it is a straight-up, you know, console-style Arkham game. And I think there's some pros and cons with that, because those games are pretty sluggish, you know? They're pretty evenly paced. Batman doesn't really run around very quickly. He doesn't move very fast. And that makes it feel more like a brawler. And I know a lot of people actually like that about it. For me, I'm more of a Spider-Man or Samus, you know, speed of a guy in these kind of games, and Batman always runs around a little too slowly for me. In 2D, that feels almost worse for some reason. Like, the game just feels really sluggish in 2D, and Batman just feels like he just kind of ambles around everywhere. He just like never seems hurried. The whole thing just has a really kind of sleepy pace to it, but And very heavy as well, in a way that feels really strange in a 2D game. But, you know, once I'd adjusted to that, I think I got way more into it. Because the exploration is fun. The environments are very detailed. And so it's kind of like in the Metroid Prime games. There, you, a lot of times you know there are secret things in the room, but it's not immediately obvious where they are. So you have to look around. You can even put your finger on the screen and do a scan to find things. So that's very Metroid Prime-y as well. And it really makes you feel like every room in the game is sort of handcrafted, and it connects to the other rooms around it in some kind of meaningful way. A lot of times it's by moving in and out of the foreground and background, which is a tricky thing to pull off in the presentation, and I think they generally do a pretty good job of it, but it absolutely makes the game disorienting. You know, because it's a 2D game, except it's not really, because you're looking all over the room and the camera's spinning around, and you can enter doors and air conditioning chutes in the floor that take you into the screen, and then the camera swivels over here and turns. And so it messes with your innate ability to kind of organize where things are laid out in a 2D game. Because it's not actually 2D. But it looks 2D. So, I mean, it really does kind of go back to Fez, you know, where that game is very difficult to navigate for a long time because it's hard to piece together how all these places connect to each other because they really are in 3D, but you can only ever see them from 2D. It's a very similar problem, and I think it resolves itself in much the same way. You just get used to it. After a while, it just kind of makes sense, but it takes a few hours really to feel natural. But it's okay.
But okay, so it takes a few hours, but isn't the game just a couple of hours?
No. I've already been playing it for like 6, and I think I've still got a good chunk to go. I mean, I haven't found that. I mean, the way Batman moves in this game, I'd be amazed if you could even run from one side of the game to the other in a matter of 2 hours. Especially right. With all the complex navigation that you constantly have to do. I mean, he is slow, really. The game moves slowly, and the environments are difficult to get around because of all this weird 3D, three-dimensional stuff you're doing. So it's not a matter of just going straight. So I don't see how anybody could beat this in 2 hours. I mean, maybe if you're doing a speed run after you already know where everything is.
That is a box quote that makes me feel like I want to die.
No, it's actually really good. But like I said, if you're hoping for a more of a Metroid-style experience or a lot of winks and nods to Metroid, they're not here, really. I mean, obviously, the Arkham series owes some of its DNA to Metroid in the first place. But just because Armature made this does not make this more of a Metroid game than, you know, Arkham City or whatever. There's a lot of other stuff going on, so it's not going to scratch your Metroid itch, which, I mean, I think I kind of secretly was hoping that it would, maybe foolishly, but, you know, that's also just not doing the game any justice if you complain about that, because I mean, it is what it is. It's really a Batman game. It's very much about that, very much feels of that series, very faithful to it. I would say, you know, much more than the Castlevania, whatever it was called, double subtitles on 3DS. So, yeah, I would recommend it. Like I said, I don't know much about the console versions. I haven't gotten a chance to check those out yet, but they're probably fine.
I kind of wonder if, like, Batman fills up the whole screen or almost, and, you know, if it looks like a handheld game on consoles.
That's interesting. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing. We've got the GBA stuff coming out.
True.
Which we're going to talk about a lot more in the second segment, but, yeah, I don't know. That's a big thing now, handheld games on... they did that with Assassin's Creed Liberation, too.
Yeah, and that game's garbage.
All right, well, why don't we move on to Guillaume?
All right, well, one of the things I have been playing on the train that doesn't require a lot of reflexes is Miles Edgeworth, Ace Attorney. I'm still not done with this. I got sidetracked with Bravely Default, and I've recently completed Case 4, so I've just started Case 5, so I'm still not done with the game. But Case 4, like, you know, when I played Ace Attorney 5, I was wondering, wow, why did I ever stop playing these games? Why did I have to take a break from these? And Case 4 of Miles Edgeworth answered this for me. It's because you spend a good, like, hour and a half trying to prove that freaking Gumshoe was sitting on a bench to eat a Swiss roll. You know, I love the series. There's a lot of great writing. There's a lot of, you know, great mysteries in there. There's a lot of fun stories and fun characters, but sometimes they're stalling, you know, and they're just trying to make the game longer, and at that point, like, that's really when those games are at their worst, and it's really, really tedious. So yeah, like, I'm not kidding, like, there's a whole segment where you're interrogating people and you're collecting clues just so that you can prove that Gumshoe was sitting at some point, and that's the reason why the judge who was in the bathroom couldn't see him eating his Swiss roll. And somehow that exonerates him from the, being a suspect or something like that. So I don't know. Like, I'm hoping that Case 5 will be better, but it's kind of been an ordeal.
Ordeal. Another box quote for you tonight.
Ah, yeah. Well,
it's a fun game, but a bit of an ordeal.
Well, yeah, no, but, you understand. I do enjoy these games, but at their worst, they're really annoying. And yeah, like there's a lot of neat stuff with Ace Attorney 5 that wasn't back in this game. Like in Ace Attorney 5, you can just hold down the B button and you can skip. You can make the dialogue display way faster, and I really miss that. With this game, it's back to waiting for each individual letters to appear. One after the other. And there's even a character in Case 4 that speaks slowly. That's his thing. So the characters display slower. And that just kills me, you know? Like, I'm just, come on, I can read faster than this. And this is not my idea of fun. And, so I miss a lot of the touches that Ace Attorney 5 brought. And 5 is just all around, I think, a much better game with much better stories. And, yeah, much less... much less plotting, I guess. So
sounds like you read too fast for Capcom in two different languages.
Yeah, well, I tend to skip ahead in games. Like, even when there's spoken dialogue, if I can read it, then, the actor is not going to finish his performance. I'm sorry. And the other thing that I've been playing is Earthbound, which, this is my first time playing Earthbound for real. I got a couple of false starts, maybe a decade ago, emulating the game and just wondering, okay, what the hell is this game about? Why does everyone think it's so awesome? And I would give up very quickly, just because you spend so much time at the beginning of the game with one single character.
The beginning of the game is the worst part by far. The worst and the hardest.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
It's really brutal because, it's kind of like a Dragon Quest game where you've got only the one character and he's very weak. Well, there's other similarities. You have a limited number of items that you can carry around. But it's all made worse by the fact that your character is so... he's really helpless. Like, you can't... The enemies just... can rob you very quickly of all of your health. You can take shots at them, but you often miss way more often than most RPGs that I've played. And you're trying to battle this bee or whatever, and you're going to miss and miss and miss. And whoa, okay, I can see that if he hits me before I hit him the next time, I'm going to die, so I'm going to heal up. So you heal up, but then, it's going to hit you, and then you're going to be at half your health. And like at the beginning, it's very much like you feel like you can't win.
I think even by the time you get to the second town, the game has become much easier.
Yeah.
And more fun, really. It follows a very similar kind of enjoyment / difficulty arc as something like Dragon Warrior 2 back on the NES. And that's another game where you start alone and then you pick up other companions as you go along. And the very first part of the game when you're by yourself and your character is kind of locked into a certain skill set and it's not very broad, it's very tough to stay alive. And it's tough to stay interested because you're just kind of pounding the button. But once you get that second person, it makes a big difference. And in Earthbound, it's really not that long. It's like maybe 2 hours, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I still think the game's fun before that, but it's very challenging until you get to that early watermark. And then from there on, it's much smoother sailing.
Right. I think it took me a little bit longer than that. But after you get the second character, it's pretty quickly you get the third one. Although you do kind of start over because at first you play as the third character alone. So you're like, oh, crap, I'm going through this again. But he seems to gain levels much more quickly. He gets help in the form of a monkey that really loves bubble gum, so that's cute. But yeah, like the so the game it does get easier, but I think that if someone here, like, I don't know, like James or whoever, wanted to make the case that the game is not a very good RPG, I think probably I know where he'd be coming from, because the combat never feels quite right to me. You do get more characters, but it just seems like only one character can do the big damage and can heal. So basically, no one else can heal unless they have healing items, and your inventory is always full, so you probably don't have healing items because you've got like rulers or other stuff that you need to solve puzzles or that you don't know. There's a lot of items that don't serve any purpose, but you don't know.
Sack yeah. crap is how I refer to the inventory. Your inventory is a sack of crap. Right.
Contractor, I think. It takes up a very precious slot in your inventory and has absolutely no use whatsoever.
Right, and there's no indication of
funny,
that.
It's funny, except when it's making it hard for you to proceed because
right.
you're having difficulty in combat. Like, there are certain things like that, you know, like condiments. Mm-hmm. You can pick up packets of ketchup and stuff like that. They only work really if you put them on other food, like a hamburger or a hot dog.
Right.
And even then, the effects are pretty minimal for most of them. So they're really generally a condiment.
But they prevent
is not,
you from carrying a hamburger
exactly.
or a hot
they're
dog.
They're not worth the opportunity cost of taking up that slot in your menu. So there's things like that that if you've played the game or if you had the strategy guide back in the 90s, you might know this stuff. But if you really are going to it cold,
yeah.
You may not realize this, and it makes the game a lot harder.
Yeah, and so, you know, and there's a lot of items. I think that you basically have to try to sell everything to know if there's any purpose to them. Because, yeah, the third character, the pack of gum that takes up one slot in your inventory, and I was sure, okay, it's probably useless, but no, you kind of need it for a puzzle. So basically, I guess the only solution other than looking at a guide would be to try to sell everything. And if they don't want to buy it, then, oh, okay, I should hang on to this then. I've got no choice.
Yeah, you're gaming the system a little bit there. But I think narratively there's something to be said for this idea, because if you think about how Earthbound is very much about like kids going out on an adventure, there's kind of a Calvin and Hobbes aspect to it. Mm. You know, if you're out there on your own, you don't really know what you're getting
you're
into.
You're going to carry a fucking protractor?
You've got a backpack full of random kid crap, and you don't know what, if anything, might become useful down the road.
And then you kill a hippie, and you take his ruler.
That's right. Well, you...
Hippies I must have rulers. Been a much better kid at planning shit than everybody else then, because I wasn't walking around with fucking protractors and gum.
Well, did you ever run away from home? I mean, it's like the wizard, okay? They're out on their own.
You're going to go with the wizard as your defense of yes. this wow. game? I think I just won forever.
It's like kid hobos. Like
Earthbound, it's so bad.
Wow.
But yeah, so Earthbound, there's a couple of things that I'm not really a fan of. But I do think it's worth sticking with just for the dialogue and the story. Like every time, I don't know, it's hard not to chuckle at the dialogue that you get that's often, you know, like confusing and completely out of nowhere. And you're just like, wow, I can't believe that they put that there. Or, you know, like, what were they on when they were writing this stuff, you know?
Yeah, I'm not going to say it's consistent thematically or like the best written game ever, but Earthbound had so much more personality and character
oh, yeah.
in the writing than anything at that time, and more than almost anything that even comes out today. And although I would agree with you, as an RPG, it is of the very simplest variety and is often frustrating in its simplicity mm-hmm. because you have very few options and you don't have a lot of customization of your characters. And the inventory is extremely brutal. But the game is worth playing through even if you don't like the battles and the character building, because that world is so odd and it's so funny and it's so unusual. And that's why people like Earthbound.
Yeah.
As somebody who is a fan of odd and unusual, I vehemently disagree. I think the combat system in this game is openly bad. And I think if you're making an RPG of that style with that kind of battle system, with that kind of world exploration, and your combat system is bad, you've made a bad game. Because that is so core and fundamental to the gameplay.
Well, yeah,
game.
I mean, it always struck me as being more just, its focus was on being quirky more than being anything else
being a good game. And I think ultimately, I mean, we have this argument about some games all the time. Can a game be good with bad gameplay? Mm. And I think maybe, but this game isn't. I think this game's gameplay is so terrible. Its combat system is so... It's not even just primitive. It just lacks... I mean, Guillaume brings up an excellent point. Only one character in your party is worth a damn. Yes. And unfortunately, you have to lug these other pointless assholes around to get anything
done.
Well,
those pointless assholes can lug more stuff for you, so...
Yeah, I mean, really mostly suitcases.
Great, they're fucking pack mules. Just let me have pack mules then. I don't even want to have to deal with their turn because it's a waste of time.
You're so antisocial, James. I'm curious, what's the farthest you ever got into Earthbound, James?
I got about two-thirds of the way through the game.
Okay, I mean, far enough to know that if the characters and story were going to overcome your dislike of the mechanics, it would have happened at that point.
I feel like the mechanics got worse the more time I spent with them. Mm-hmm. Like, they became more upsetting and more just genuinely to the point of, I can't believe Nintendo published a game with such bad combat.
Yeah, and not just the combat. Like, there's status effects that you get all the time. So I just went through the desert, and you can get a sunstroke, which is funny. Like, don't get me wrong, it's really funny. And you can mm-hmm. buy wet towels to, you know, to cure the sunstroke, and that's also very
so
funny.
Awesome.
But the sunstroke, like, you wandered that desert for a long time if you don't know exactly what you're looking for. And there's a couple of red herrings in there. Like, there's a black sesame seed and a white sesame seed that you find in a desert. And they have, like, this love story together. And I looked up at that point. I looked up the guide and it said, yeah, they don't do anything. So, okay, thanks
like,
for telling
the,
me.
The swamp is kind of the same way. 'Cause I think you get poisoned in
I'm
the swamp.
I'm not there yet.
But it takes forever to get
right.
through. So you're constantly getting poisoned with your inventory full of freaking protractors. It's like, great game. I mean, it feels like the game is actively trying to make you miserable.
Right. Like in the desert place, like only, the main character can get rid of status effects unless you have those wet towels, but your inventory is full of crap. So you're not going to buy, you know, 8 wet towels to get through that desert. So basically you're going to use your main character to heal every time. And then there's very few items that replenish your magic points. So eventually your main character becomes almost useless, you know, and at that point no one
and everybody else is but useless by default, so it's a good
yeah. So I'm not a fan of that, but I am a fan of the dialogue. Like, it's really funny, and it's funny to compare between Bravely Default and this, because Bravely Default had really good gameplay and story mm-hmm. that I didn't care for. It still kept me engaged for 30 hours, but eventually once the you know, like, it felt like it was stalling. I just gave up. And now we have this, and I used to give up much more quickly, but now that I've made it through the roughest part, I think I'm in it for the long haul, and I'm going to see this game through. I'm in Foreside now, so I don't know, like, just what
it's
number.
Pretty far.
Okay. So hopefully I'll be done pretty quickly.
John, you're an Earthbound fan, aren't you?
I've never actually played it all the way through. I don't mind it. I mean, mm-hmm. I haven't really gotten too far into it, but you know, I've kind of gotten far enough to sort of see the issues that Guillaume is talking about. I mean, I've always felt
yeah,
that it just gets,
I acknowledge them.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
I
think it gets by a lot on its kind of, its charm and the fact that it's so different and witty and unlike anything else that's out there. And I think that's really why people fall in love with it, is because it is so singular. Like, there's really mm-hmm. nothing else
yes.
out there like it. So
even Mother 3, I don't like as much. And it's funny, James, I don't remember you hating on it to the level that you are Earthbound.
I don't think the combat is as utterly just garbage.
Okay.
In 3.
I remember it being very similar, but maybe there's some
subtleties.
It's
similar, but
it's
not as full of situations that are just frustrating to the point where they obviously deliberately made this frustrating.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't like Mother 3. I mean, I was pretty upfront about that. I don't think Mother 3 is a very good game. But I think it's marginally better than Earthbound in that it doesn't deliberately frustrate you.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
have you guys tried Earthbound Zero at all?
No. I've heard it's actually the most difficult to get into.
Yeah, because you've basically got... I think you've got only one character throughout the whole game. And you,
well, you
get
basically
four...
only have one character now, so whatever.
Yeah, I know. But and you also get only four different weapons. So it's got this weird difficulty curve where it's, you know, it's really, really tough. And then you get the baseball bat. And then it's easy. And then you progress through the game and the baseball bat is not enough, but you haven't reached the next weapon. So you're really struggling and then you get the next weapon. And, you know, like it would be like a seesaw, the difficulty curve. It's really, I haven't made it through. And the dialogue and the situations are not as funny as Earthbound.
No, I wouldn't think so. All right. Well, enough about that. You know, always an interesting game to bring up because people do have such different opinions of it. I happen to be a pretty big fan of it, although I'm not a super fan. I'm not actually sure I've ever beaten it. I've seen it beaten by friends, and I've played through almost all of it myself, but I think my save file died on my old Super Nintendo cartridge or something like that one time. Something weird happened, and I was frustrated. I lost about maybe 20 or 25 hours worth of progress, and I was like, I don't want to start over right now. So I'm hoping to go all the way on the Wii U version, which I play about an hour a month, so it might be a while.
Wow, you really love this game.
It's just that I've played it before, and I have so many things I haven't played before. But right. I do like Earthbound so much, and it's so convenient having it on the gamepad that I do occasionally bust it out and play it just a little bit to keep it fresh, keep it going. Hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to John. Did you have anything this week, John, that you want to talk about?
Well, you know, now that we've talked about Earthbound again, I want to talk about Smash tournaments. Just kidding. Yeah, so my 3DS is finally on the way back. It died, of course, and was sent off to Nintendo of America. And so several weeks have gone by, and it's finally on its way back to me. Now, I still have the loaner they sent me. I got to send that guy back with Mylon Secret Castle on it. Can't say I'm sad to see that one go. But that's I don't really know what's going to come back on my 3DS.
My it's going to come back with 10 copies of Mylon Secret Castle. And they're all outside the castle.
Right? Yeah, I'm expecting just like the only game on it will be Mylon Secret Castle because it's, you know, something will happen where they just downloaded the newest thing onto
it. And you go into the eShop and it's the only game listed.
Yeah, and then the Twilight Zone episode will end.
Am I crazy for thinking in Japan it might have been one of the Famicom classics released on GBA?
God bless it.
God bless Japan.
That would be a fun collector's item for me.
God bless that game.
you're going to look outside and the shovel will be sitting in the window and then the episode ends.
Yeah. So, yeah. So,
Hey, John, let me read your fortune real quick. Find the saw. Find the saw. The Alamo.
God damn it.
So yeah, I rest assured the first thing I do, I'm going to assess exactly what's left over on that 3DS and then download Mylon Secret Castle as soon as humanly possible. So yeah, the other thing I wanted to talk about, just not really particularly my new business, but new business in general, is the news that we got about Mario Kart 8. Very controversial. I'm a huge fan of Mario Kart Wii, as everybody on the podcast is aware.
Mm. Have you ever dreamed, have you ever wished that you could play the same game but in HD?
You know, dreams do come true, Guillaume, because... I mean, I can tell you that I have wanted to honk my horn with the gamepad, so that's, again, dreams.
Your dreams are coming true.
Yeah, you know, dare to dream. That's what I can tell our audience, just dare to dream.
I was so happy and at the same time disgusted to see in the images we had it was still there. I was like, thank you, Nintendo, for making my life on this podcast easy.
Yeah, so...
And at the same time, fuck you, Nintendo, seriously?
So, yeah, so, you know, my day started today with a press release about Mario Kart 8, and I noticed that it said, as a selling point, it said for the first time in HD. And I kind of got a chuckle out of that. It's 2014. I mean, it's...
John, I would like to... I have this wonderful mental image of you paying a service that has a paperboy come by, ring his little bell on his bicycle, and throw you a custom-printed newspaper that has every Thursday morning's eShop press release printed on it for you to read with your coffee and bagel.
What is this?
I wish. If only I lived in that world, Johnny.
I read mine with a cup of whiskey sitting next to me and then go, oh. Yeah.
At 7 a.m.
God damn it, Nintendo.
Yeah, so... Yeah, so it's the first time it's in HD, if you didn't realize that.
I would have liked it if they said, possibly in HD. We'll see.
Yeah. So
what if they had just called it Mario Kart HD?
Yeah.
It would have been a more honest declaration.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbering nonsense aside, because their numbers are actually wrong, beyond that, just to even give this an iterative number might not be super fair.
Yeah, I mean, so what they actually did announce, they announced three new characters. It was Metal Mario, Lakitu, and Shy Guy.
What I've always wanted.
Yeah, so...
Metal Mario!
That's cool. And they also announced, I think, a couple of weapons. They announced, I think, the Piranha Plant and Boomerang. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
I like the Piranha Plant.
Yeah, the Piranha Plant's actually pretty cool. You'll be able to chomp players ahead of you. I believe
yeah, just like in the Super Mario 3D World.
Yep. So that's pretty good. The new tracks. What new tracks did they announce? I didn't.
There was a lot of retro ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of retro ones.
They're doing a lot of retro remakes, which is actually cool, and that's the one area where I think this game being in HD is actually maybe more 3D in some cases is the bigger, more notable leap.
There's a joke here about the whole game being a retro remake.
Would never go that far. But, I mean, half the tracks in the game are classic tracks, but a lot of them have been basically remade from
new items, characters, and tracks make for a head over heels fun in Mario Kart 8. Fuck you, Nintendo.
Somebody had to say
God damn it.
So yeah, I mean, now somebody on Twitter said that it being in HD, I mean, humor aside, is a legitimate selling point, and that is true, because this series has never been in HD, and the novelty of that is cool. However overdue it is. I mean, so, you know, will I get this? Of course I'll get it. And will I enjoy it? Of course I'll enjoy it. But there's just, you can't help. I know Neil, he's posted several things on our site that have been bemoaning kind of the lack of anything really innovative in it. You know, you have the anti-gravity stuff, which is going to be cool, but I feel like that's kind of more, it's kind of more icing on the cake rather than a new cake or a new part of the cake.
Sure,
or
it's not, yeah, it's not something we haven't seen in kart-style racing games before.
Yeah.
Well, but it doesn't even really change the way you play the game. I think it's really cosmetic. It's mostly there to look cool for the people who are watching you.
Yeah.
Or what? Maybe it's to give you something interesting to look at as you, you know, bloat your way through 50cc. But this game is like right up there with Donkey Kong for me. It's like, well, it sure is an HD version of that thing that you put out on Wii that sold a lot of copies.
Mm-hmm. Now, the big elephant in the room, I mean, they did talk about the online stuff finally. It's 12-player online, and I believe 2-player local, or you'll be able to go online with 2 players. Pretty much the same.
So, yeah, it's exactly the same as
Mario Kart Wii. Yep. Yeah. So, but that is... That is what scares me. The fact that it's, again, we've said this before, that it's this close to release, really not, I mean, has anybody actually even played the online stuff hands-on?
No, they've publicly. Never shown it. They've never even talked about it. I mean,
I think they've intimated
either
it
there's
was
nothing
be there.
To say, either there's just nothing left to say, or there's something really big. I mean, it's at least going to have some kind of Miiverse integration. I mean, that's, to me, the killer feature in this game that actually makes me want to go buy it. Is that I can play online with my friends so much more easily than I could ever before.
And draw
because
dicks
there
on
are
screenshots.
No friend codes.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, apparently there's some sort of highlight reel thing, so you can. I'm assuming you can post that to Miiverse. So
probably.
Yeah, I'm not talking about posting anything. Yeah. I'm talking about Miiverse as a matching service like Xbox Live Gold or PSN.
Whoa, I mean, Johnny! Don't get ahead of yourself. Now you're just talking crazy.
I want to know.
No, it kind of worked on Call of Duty, and I mean Nintendo. I don't think has really shown that yet. Not in a game with a really heavy online component on Wii U. But I think this is their chance. And this, to me, this is very much a proof of concept. If they pull this off,
yeah. So am I looking forward to it? Of course, but I'm kind of expecting more of the same. And that's pretty much what, from what I've seen, that's pretty much what's coming. Is more of the same, which is kind of disappointing because, you know, you would expect Nintendo to really go above and beyond at this point, especially with kind of what's going on with Wii U. But
I've missed the last two Mario Karts. I didn't play Wii. I didn't get Wii, and I didn't get 7.
Mm-hmm.
And you
Seven
think-
is weird. It's so forgettable. I mean, I played it a lot for like 2 weeks and then hardly ever touched it again.
But you,
and
you
I would- have... I have no ill will towards it whatsoever. I didn't have a bad time with it. I just, I can barely even remember what it looks like or what the tracks are.
I feel exactly the same way about it.
It just came and went.
You would think that I would have some inclination that, okay, well, I'll get this, quote, eight. But honestly, there's nothing exciting I'm looking at here. I mean, it's just, ugh.
Mm-hmm.
I need something. You need to give me something. Like, even if it was something simple, like they've reconfigured, like, battle modes and stuff, or added other gameplay.
And maybe they have.
But if they haven't said anything about it. The first point wouldn't be that if you bump into certain obstacles, you go faster. That wouldn't be the leading point in the press release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. But the people who played it mostly really enjoyed it, you know, varying degrees of...
Well, yeah, it's a Mario Kart game.
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of enjoying
it's gonna
it.
It's going to be really fun. I mean,
I just don't
paid for all the other ones, and
this is kind of like I feel like this is just I feel like we should call this entire bit like when fun just isn't enough. Because I really feel we're all sitting here saying, yeah, it's Mario Kart and it's going to be a lot of fun, but
yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm just not excited.
Yeah,
but I will be buying it on release.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that I always want to have on the console that is hooked up. And right now I have a Wii U hooked up and not a Wii. So I want to get that new Mario Kart because it kind of goes with the system. When people come over, I want it to be there. But I'm not super excited for it as a game experience. Like, I don't think it's going to be this fresh new thing that is going to blow my mind. I hope it is. So far, I haven't really seen anything that makes me think that's going to happen. I'm definitely open to it, but I'm okay buying it because I don't want to have to drag out the GameCube to play Double Dash. You know, as much as I love that game, it's just a hassle. There's a convenience factor. It's like a $60, you know, Mario Kart up port fee every 3 or 4 years. And I'm not
You're
happy
just
about
encouraging
that, but
them.
I like the game and I'm going to play the shit out of it. So, you know, it's like, this is Madden. I mean, someone on Twitter today mentioned, like, this is Nintendo's Madden, and it totally is. It's like, I always want the newest one, even though I'm never really 100% happy about it.
Yeah. It's...
But I like it a lot, you know? I mean, I'm not down on it. It's just like, it feels perfunctory, the whole thing. Even me buying it and playing through it feels like a foregone conclusion. Like, I already know exactly how much fun it's going to be.
Like, 6 months from now, it's like you could just fast forward the whole thing.
I could write the review for this game.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah, it's,
I haven't even played it.
It's probably what, like, you think an 8.5?
Yeah, just go ahead and write. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's an 8.5. Yes. I mean, and I'm the 8.5 guy.
The 8.5 is the Mario Kart score.
It's like, I know 8.5 games.
Shut up, John.
This guy right here.
God damn it.
I know 8.5 games, all right?
No, it's just not interesting. But, God, I hope it's fun. I think it will be. We'll know in a few weeks. But let's wrap up new business with James.
8.5, John. So I have been playing Saints Row 4, which I picked up a couple days ago. And people who have been listening to the show for a little while remember that when I got 3, it was kind of a revelation. Like, I something about 3, just the absurdity, the bombasticness of it, the fact that you can walk around and not act without consequence, but with complete disregard for consequence, and just be
right,
just do whatever you felt like doing. The fact that
doesn't even pretend to moralize to you the way GTA does.
The fact there was this city that was essentially just the shithole. I mean, Steelport is an awful place. Even the parts of Steelport that are nice are awful places. And you can just tear those places to shreds if you feel like it. And it's not that no one cares. It's that you have no reason to be upset about it. You know, I told the story on the show that my favorite moment in the game was after I gained the invincibility power. I just put the controller down one day and was doing something else, and some dude from another gang came up and punched me. And when I came back, it turned into a giant gang war. And the whole, like, people had just stopped driving by and started shooting. It was just a complete disaster. I hadn't done anything. I wasn't even touching the controller. And to me, that was amazing because here's this completely chaotic, just seemingly just nuts world that was alive, because all this stuff happened without my intervention at all. A dude walked up and punched me, and my crew saw it, got out of their car and shot him, and his crew got out of their car, and then the police showed up and the military, and it just got way out of hand.
It's emergent gameplay, systems of systems interacting
and
with each
everything,
other.
Everything is
input.
Just on the edge of being broken. It's just skirting yes. that edge of being
Absolutely.
Broken. And it does it. And I mean, that whole scenario shouldn't have happened. There's no reason for him to have walked up and punched me. The game just decided I was threatening him because my guns were out, even though I wasn't touching the controller. So he walks up and punches me. And it broke the whole world. I mean, the game was going through just terrible slowdown, and there were literally items just... There were so many items on the ground for people who have died in this war that broke out that it was struggling to render them. And it was just...
that's great.
It's an unbounded problem.
There were at least 15 cars stacked up, and at one point somebody threw a grenade and they all blew up and the game just freaked out. And I mean, I watched it captivated for like 5 minutes as just carnage just tore, literally was tearing the game's engine apart.
I bet it would have crashed itself.
If I hadn't stopped it, it would have crashed itself.
It would have run out of RAM,
I basically just said,
just all crashed.
Right, that's enough of this, and went all superhero mode and wiped out everything. But
yeah, I mean, Saints Row, is, like, especially 3 and 4, are like the Wolf of Wall Street of video games. I mean, they are so amoral. They're so over the top and ridiculous, and they just don't
and
care.
Boring.
And no, they're not boring at all.
But here, so I awesome. Picked up 4, and I know, I mean, I'm going to spoil the first 10 seconds of the game. In 4, you've been abducted. You've become the president, and you've been abducted by aliens. And you think, well, mm-hmm. this game's already starting off on a high note. And
then they put you
in the
Matrix.
Yeah, the entire game takes place in this virtual world. Now, I don't remember the entire situation here. I want to say they were developing an add-on to 3, and they had just started developing 4, and they said, screw it, mash them together, and we'll make this 4. And that's kind of how 4 got out so quickly. So in this sort of post-apocalyptic Matrix steelport, your job is essentially to disrupt the computer programs in the game, which basically means just breaking all kinds of law and order to make the whole thing not work right. And you get crazy things like deliberate breaking of the graphics engine, where characters' eyes will bulge out of their heads, or characters will be walking upside down, or polygons will get stretched way out of proportion. And
more importantly, your character just turns into Superman plus, you know,
yeah,
whatever
so
else.
Your character, because there is a hacker outside the Matrix giving you Matrix powers, you
yes.
basically become God in the first 20 minutes of the game. You can...
It's so
you can
easy.
Run,
this game
so yeah,
is
you can run
ridiculously it, easy.
You run faster than cars, and when you fully upgrade your speed, you run so fast it's almost uncontrollable. You can jump over buildings... Uh-huh. You can jump over rivers. I mean, it's you can shoot fireballs and ice balls, and you can cause massive earthquakes by slamming your foot down. It's so over the top and just giving you all these powers that it's kind of taking some of the fun away from me. So part of what I liked about 3 was that I would, you know, we'd hang out at the Saints penthouse, and somebody would go, yo, boss, we got a problem. And you go, where is it? And you go look at the map, and you go, oh, God, it's all the way across town. Well, let's get in the car. And you'd pull out whatever ridiculous car you've made that day, and you've put 26-inch rims on a lowrider, and you've painted the entire thing gold, and you took the roof off to make it a convertible because that's more styling, even though it means your ass is getting shot the whole time, but you don't care, whatever. And yet you've tinted the windows because that's how I roll, even though it has no roof. And you've put an underkit on it because why not? And spikes and nitrous, because you need all these things. And you drive over there, and on the way you probably stop 20 times to get involved in like a turf war, or just to stop and just cause mayhem, or maybe
to sing a song.
Or somebody on another gang runs you off the road, and you could just let it go, but no, that's not how the Saints roll. You get out and you take care of this shit. And like it's real engrossing. Like you feel like you're a member of this gang of sociopaths who just can let nothing go. Any opportunity to just drop the gloves and go, they take it. And if there's not one there, they make their own. Like, you just drive past some guys on the street, another gang, and then someone maybe go like, hey, what's up? You're like, no, that's it. We got to go. And you get out and you start a war. And it's just, you just need to. It becomes compulsive. In 4...
You had a very different experience with Saints Row 3 than I did. But let's get back to 4 real quick.
In 4...
Is it just that you feel it's just a little too far outside of reality? It's just takes itself a little too silly?
Yeah, it's weird. The world doesn't feel alive in 4. I mean, it's not. It's a virtual world. But there's way less people in it. It's the character density is much, much smaller. In 3, there are people everywhere.
Yeah, that might be because they've drastically changed the speed at which you move around the
environment. Oh, it totally is. And you don't have any reason to get out and drive. You don't have a gang that you're working with. I mean, you're basically flying solo the whole game. And you're just going from point to point to do business. And you move so fast, and there's so little going on around you. There's not much reason to stop and just be a sociopath. And the world itself, because it's this virtual world, it's very dark, it's very grimy, it's very dim. There's not the contrast of you going super nuts in the middle of what is essentially just a city. It's the complete divorce from reality in a game that was already super divorced from reality. I think it just took it too far. I think ultimately you lose, although I say there's no consequences for your action, it almost just feels like your actions are pointless in this case. I mean, it's not even like, you don't even get the joy of watching, you know, enemies drive around corner coming up as you start, you know, you start a beef. And there's all kinds of crap going on, and you're waiting for enemies to come around the corner in their car so you can nail them with a rock-propelled grenade. And you're just standing there waiting for them, like, sup, boys? In this case, they literally just warp in right next to you, and it's just a constant process. You can't outrun them because they're literally teleporting right next to you. It lacks the kind of just disorganized chaos of the first of 3, the first game like this, because
it's much more like those open-world Spider-Man games.
It really, like. When I'm playing it, I mean, the missions are great. The missions are stupid and ridiculous, and I just did one where I fought a giant can of Saints Flow, which is their this gang has sold their license to a soda company to make an energy drink. So you're fighting a dude dressed as a mascot, as which is just running a giant can, except he's like Godzilla sized, and you fight him using what is essentially that town's version of Lady Liberty. Like, you just take it like it's a Ghostbusters homage, but. It's a giant soda can, and you beat him by opening the top and pouring out the soda and then throwing him through a steel beam. It's ridiculous, and I love it. I love that stuff.
It's awesome.
The world just doesn't feel the same, and that was what I loved about Saints Row 3, was I loved this big, stupid world that was alive in spite of my best efforts to kill it.
Yeah, I do feel like if they keep making that series, I don't know if they will. Now that THQ is gone, you know, I don't know that the new owners are going to want to go back into that well, but if they do, I think they're probably going to end up having to pull back on that stuff a little bit.
Yeah. Cause I can feel where this game was being designed as an add-on, because a lot of add-ons to games like this, you get kind of a more constrained version of the world that contains the places the add-on takes place. You know, the world may still be there, but there's less going on, and it feels like there's a lot less going on in this Steelport than the real one that you were playing in the third game. And that's kind of a shame, because to me, Steelport was the best character in the game. Because you drive around these different places, and they have different personalities, they have different things going on, and ultimately, you can cause all kinds of different mayhem in them. Whereas this game, I don't really stop anywhere. I don't notice the town, because I'm running like Flash through the town, to the point where I'm running with such speed that I'm on a highway bowling cars out of the way simply by the shockwave I'm leaving behind me. And that's cool, and it's fun, but it's not the kind of fun that I want to have. It's like a, yeah.
It turns the city into a level much more, rather than a place you inhabit.
Right.
The city becomes an obstacle course, and it's fun to jump around it. It's fun to, you know, try to jump on 10 or 20 buildings in a row without ever touching the ground, which you
can very easily
do. You know, it's fun to like float over huge swaths of water or parks or something like that, you know, so that you never have to do any. My goal was always to do as little running as possible. I wanted to be in the air all the time, just like Spider-Man, you know, like, and it plays great that way. But it is a completely different experience than the previous game.
And
for sure.
For me, as a person who just enjoyed that world, it kind of takes something away from it. And I feel like they built the game knowing that you're going to be going at top speed, because if I try to take it slow, there ain't much to do. I will say, though, best mission I've ever seen in a game, and deliberately aimed this mission at the ESRB. Your characters kill drug dealers to take drugs that break the game so you get even more powerful to the point where the entire game becomes just a complete, like, the game can't even render what's going on. Like, it's just like they've distorted everybody's perspective and they pixelate the whole game. So imagine you're running way faster than the engine is really built to handle, but now they've pixelated the whole world like it's 3D dot Game Heroes. You feel like you're going to vomit the entire time the game is being played. And meanwhile, the other characters are harassing you about your inability to hold your drugs. I'm like, wow, ESRB did not like this particular section of the game. They were not a fan.
It's quite a strange game. Well, we're going to have to wrap up new business. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Game Boy Advance.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First this week, we have impressions of Mario Kart 8 by Neil Ronahan. Oh, hey, Mario Kart, it's good to see you again. It's been a while, eh? Yeah, you can put the coat in the bedroom. You remember where that is, right? Man, I was kind of hoping he'd skip this party. We're going to hear that same story about the finding the blue shell again. Hey, man, oh! Story, great, awesome. We also have a feature, your guide to the April GBA VC games by Zach Miller. Shit, it doesn't work out of order. Never mind, we'll pick that up later. Johnny, why don't you go next?
Okay.
Son of a bitch!
Well laid plan. Next up, we have an editorial called Mario Kart 8's Use of the Gamepad is Disappointing by Neil. Despite Neil's insistence, Mario Kart 8 is the next generation of touchscreen horn honking. You need to respect that. There's also a feature called Your Pro Guide to Rusty's Real Deal Baseball by Don Koopman. Nintendo's next foray into free-to-play, not really, comes in the form of baseball activities as purchased from a cartoon dog. Of course, we need to get to the bastion of baseball for the facts on this one, Europe. That game's right. Really cool, by the way. You should all check it out.
All right, and we have a feature. The most asked questions about the Wii U GBA Virtual Console, again, by Don Koopman. Don takes a look at some of the features that GBA VC has on Wii U. He does miss the obvious question. You mean GBA Virtual Console on 3DS, right? And we have a review of Skater Cat for 3DS by Addison Webb. It's a game where you play as a cat who skates. I'd call this a mobile game, but it does appear that this is a 3DS title with some positives. Sadly, it does appear to have some negatives. Not listed among Addison's complaints. What the hell is Skater Cat?
Garfield?
What?
I don't know. Heathcliff. He was a skateboard cat.
I don't... Anyway, we have... Lastly this week, we have a feature. Your Guide to the April GBA VC Games by Zach Miller. Want to know even more about the GBA's Wii U Picnic? Zach has a list of info about each game scheduled for this month.
It's taking over the site.
Today.
All right, well, go check out all of your 2014 Game Boy Advance coverage and much more Nintendo coverage over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for our special feature, a little retrospective on the Game Boy Advance. And I wanted to do it this week because, of course, GBA games are launching around the world on the Wii U Virtual Console. So a lot of people, I hope, are going to be talking about GBA games and about that system. And I was thinking, like, I'm not sure that we've ever done, like, a really huge look at that particular system on the show. We've done Super Nintendo and we've done DS back on episode 200, but we haven't.
Some of us got to do an N64 one.
That's right.
Asshole.
you guys did your own after a while, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's cool. But we've never really talked in depth about GBA, and I thought that would be fun to do. So let's talk about it. Of course, GBA came out in the year 2001. It was had been shown previously at Space World in 2000, which I think was the first time anyone got to play it. And I remember, I think, playing it at E3 2001, which was like maybe a couple of weeks before it came out in June. That's back when E3 was in May. So it was really cool to play a new Nintendo system like right before it came out, because it was like, it's a very mature product. There's a lot of ready to launch games on it. And it was really exciting to play them at E3 for the first time and to know that it's not one of those things I'm going to have to wait a full year or 2 years before I get to play more of them. They're coming out in like 2 weeks. But it was still fresh. It was still new. And GBA was pretty exciting because I think a lot of people felt Game Boy Color had been sort of a half step away from, you know, I mean, the games generally looked a lot like Game Boy games, just but in color. So it didn't feel like a huge technical leap, even though it's technically a different platform and it has exclusive games and things. It just wasn't really all that huge of a leap. And GBA felt at the time like a really big deal. And this was also, keep in mind, before there was really any competition. Especially in America, we didn't have WonderSwan Color and stuff like that going on. The Neo Geo Pocket Color wasn't really a factor. And so GBA was really like the big new handheld. This was before PSP. This was before Vita. So it was a big deal.
Yeah, and it was also a big deal that the games looked like Super Nintendo games, which have, you know, the Super Nintendo, I think, is well loved by most Nintendo fans. So, yeah, it
was... By most smart people.
Yeah.
Oh, Johnny, you're so judgmental.
And it was, you know, like, it's easy to kind of, I don't know, scoff today at, oh, wow, it can do Super Nintendo graphics. But yeah, like, jumping from the Game Boy to that, it was really impressive. We hadn't seen anything like the PSP, you know, which was years away. So, yeah, I think my jaw was on the floor.
I think it was also... It was perfect timing because this was right around, you know, in 2000, 2001, you got to remember that there was starting to become a real backlash against 3D graphics because they had completely taken over the industry on consoles. And there were a lot of people who felt at that time, and I think with good reason, felt that the games really didn't look that great.
Well, they didn't perform that great. Keep in mind, frame rate on PlayStation was abysmal. And on the N64,
oh, yeah, and N64 had... tons of problems.
It was either terrible or eh.
Well, the other big thing about N64 is that even when it ran smoothly, a lot of games did, the graphics weren't super detailed. You know, right. It could only run so many polygons. It didn't have much texture memory. A lot of these things improved drastically over the next couple of generations of consoles. But this was a period in which 3D games were starting to lose some of their novelty, and people were starting to be a little more critical of the way that they looked and the way that they performed. And they said, video games used to be a lot smoother and faster and prettier than this. And so I think it was a really nice time to bring back a kind of a powerful 2D handheld system with really bright, lush, well, bright is arguable, but you know, big, colorful, highly detailed, high resolution graphics. There was a big desire for that. And I think it did, you know, that's a big part of the reason that the system did well, actually.
Afterburner aside.
Honestly, I think a big reason the system did well was, and I've spoken about this before on the show. It's been a little while, so I'll kind of go back over this theory. I had a Game Boy in 1991, probably maybe even a little bit before that. So I mean, I had a Game Boy for a really long time, and I had that same Game Boy all the way through Game Boy Color, and I got a GBA roughly after it came out, pretty soon to when it launched, and I was actively involved in Game Boy gaming the entire time I had that system. And there was a distinct moment where Game Boy games went from being bad ports of NES games or movie tie-in games that were just hellacious is probably the nicest word I could think of for them, and or things like Cool Spot. I mean, just stuff that doesn't really function as a game in and of itself. And there were some gems in there, but by and large, it was a dumping ground for licensed stuff to where people started putting real hard development resources on their handheld games. And to me, that moment, at least in the West, I know in Japan the situation wasn't this one-sided, was with the release of the Pokemon games. Mm. And to me, that continued on through the Game Boy Color, which had some really amazing games. Like to the point, handheld games before the Game Boy Color came out, there was nothing that compared to them, regardless of color, just in the depth of gameplay that was available in these systems. And I think it's sort of... Pokemon obviously put these systems in people's hands, and I think there was enough good, high-quality content coming out that people continued to play it. So when the Game Boy Advance came out relatively close to the release of the Game Boy Color, it was about 2 years?
Yep.
2.5 years.
It was... people were ready to move up to upgrade, because they may have had a Game Boy for a year when the Game Boy Color came out because they bought it with Pokemon. And then, so to make that jump wasn't as big of a deal because they'd already done it once in relatively short order. And they were experiencing really well put together content. And that continued when the GBA launched. I'm trying to remember how many games it launched with. It wasn't a ton, but some of these games, they looked really good. They played well. I remember the Rayman game that came out on GBA looked amazing.
Yeah.
That was it launch or right after launch?
But I'm not sure about that one. I mean, I remember getting Pinobi, which was the first game by R-Toon, who later famously screwed up Yoshi's Island on DS. But and Blinks the Cat, I guess. But I thought Pinobi was actually surprisingly good, and it just looked so nice. You know, it was a very drastic change. And it's funny, as you were talking, James, I thought back to Chris Kohler's book, Powered Up, where he talks about when Super Nintendo came out, and parents all over the country were pissed that
right.
Nintendo was making a new system that their old games wouldn't work on, and that the new games, they were going to stop making NES games and start making Super Nintendo games, so there wouldn't be any new games for their kids. And they felt that they were being like scammed into buying new hardware. And I'm just thinking, like, how much has Nintendo reprogrammed us as a society since that time? You know, and GBA is like the perfect example. There's so many versions of it, and a lot of people owned all of them. And I know people, I mean, this is a sliver of a sliver, but I know people who owned pretty much every version that came out and kept them all. Like, for me, it was more of an upgrade path. It's like, oh yeah, I'll buy your SP and give away my old GBA to my sister. But some people are like, I gotta collect all of these, you know. Right. And GBA, I felt, was the first time that they started releasing so many different versions, like not just different colors, which they did on the old Game Boy, but
right.
Like, you know, there's the SP and the Micro, and there's the backlit SP.
There was the Game Boy had the Pocket, and then in Japan it had the Light, and there was obviously the Color. So, I mean, they went through about four hardware iterations on their Game Boy.
Yeah, so, true.
I mean, it had its
but
I mean,
over
that was
a much
out,
longer period.
That was spread out over about 20 years. The Game Boy Advance spread out about four.
Right.
So I just
like, remember when
count.
Reggie pulled the Micro out of his pocket, and everybody's like, another fucking GBA?
Damn, yeah, I know. It got kind of ridiculous after a while.
It hasn't been that long since the last one came out.
We were like, oh, maybe they're serious about this third pillar garbage. There were 16 launch Game Boy Advance games in the U.S.
Well, that's,
and they include,
that's
they
a include, lot.
They included things like Circle of the Moon, Choo Choo Rocket, Fire Pro Wrestling, which I like, although I know it's not, you know, a widely regarded game.
Still good. Really
Rayman
good.
Rayman Advance, the Tony Hawk Pro Skater 2, which is actually really good on GBA.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I remember for that game, that was one of the games that Activision actually flew me out to San Francisco to play that.
Holy
which
shit.
One?
Yep, that was the GBA one for the Tony Hawk GBA
oh,
game.
Tony, seriously?
Yes.
Wow.
Yep.
To play a GBA game.
Correct.
Oh, that's hard to imagine.
I remember,
that's
I,
hard
oh,
to believe.
And of course, Mario Advance.
Yeah, which was... That was, to me, a big deal because they chose to do Mario 2.
Yeah.
You know, Super Mario USA. I thought that was a strange choice as a launch title.
This is
title.
The beginning of what becomes the Super Mario Advance crazy-ass numbering system.
Right.
Yeah.
Where you end up with, like, Super Mario Advance 2, Mario World 3. You're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Stop it.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, that was, to me, it just seems like... People had already been conditioned to buy these handheld devices to play these relatively rich experiences. And if you look at the GBA launch, I mean, it came out swinging pretty hard. I mean, the Iridian 3D, which is a game
cool,
that we have
a,
some...
It's a tech demo, but it's really cool.
It looks really cool.
Yeah, it looks great. It's not that much fun to play, but it was a show-off thing. Especially because, I mean, portable devices with actual, even color screens... Well, I mean, this is back in the days of like black and white Palm Pilots and stuff like that, you know, and like little shitty Nokia phones that, you know, have 9 buttons. So any kind of color display, especially one that actually looks sharp like that, that was unusual. And I think also it's worth noting GBA was really cheap. Even at launch, I want to say it was like $149, which is probably, if I'm right about that, that's probably cheaper than the original Game Boy launched at if you adjust for inflation or pretty close to it. So it's not like nowadays when they release a $350 3DS at launch, it felt primed to be a big hit from the very beginning. You know, it had so much publisher support. And I remember being excited about that too, because third parties never got really serious about Game Boy Color. I mean, I think they probably saw that it was a stopgap, which it absolutely was. But you remember third parties had not been around for N64, and right. GameCube wasn't out yet. And they would turn out to be not really all that awesome on GameCube either. But in the summer of 2001, we were so starved for third party anything that it was exciting to see this menagerie of games at, right at launch, and to see that companies like Konami and Capcom and eventually Square Enix were like seriously interested in supporting this platform. And that was that made that system so much more fully fleshed out than the N64 had been. And you know, and thankfully something that Nintendo managed to keep up with DS, not so much on 3DS so far, but I think it makes the GBA a very healthy library, even given that it was only around for about, you know, 3 years before the DS kind of came alongside and said, hey, I'll take over from here.
Sup.
Yeah, and pretty much, and did actually take over everything.
Mm. So, yeah, surprisingly, although it got off to a slow start. GBA was felt like a big hit right from the very beginning. Like, everybody I knew was getting them, and it was also the first, I think it was the first system that Nintendo launched in the internet age. So it felt like everybody was talking about it because everybody I was talking to was on the internet, you know, like, yeah. It felt like it was a shared experience much more than the N64 had been, which was really the most previous big time launch they'd done.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I actually gave away my GBA SP because of the DS. So that was kind of a big deal. You know, usually I don't give anything away, and actually I regret it. I should never give anything away, but yeah. So
I mean, you could still play those games for the most part.
But oh, yeah. No more Four Swords Adventures for you. I'm sorry.
Nope.
I got my GBA. I didn't buy it at launch. It must have been around the time that Golden Sun came out.
Mm.
So a couple years, about a year and a half later, I guess.
Okay.
Golden Sun they had made a big deal out of. I felt like that was a real event. Mm-hmm. Nintendo, it was the return of 16-bit RPGs, and that really meant something back then.
The thing is, it was a return of 16-bit RPGs, except it looked better than them.
It did look. I mean, yeah. Golden Sun is very impressive graphically on that system. Yeah.
Actually, it was about 6 months after the system launched. God, that was fast.
Yeah, but there was a lot of hype for that game. A lot of hype.
Yeah, and it seemed like this was going to be like the next big franchise, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was the great white hope of GBA for a lot of people, and I remember giving that game a 7, I think, on our site, and getting a ton of flack from people. Like people, even, you know, mostly people who hadn't even played it yet, mm-hmm. But just people who wanted it to be so amazing. I was like, it's good, but...
Yeah.
You know, it's not Chrono Trigger. Sorry. It's
no.
not.
No.
But yeah, like I think that the it became quickly obvious to me that we needed a new model of GBA almost as soon as I got it, because I got one of those Nyko kind of worm lights, you know, mm-hmm. which didn't do shit. You plugged
the worm
it,
light was the height of Nyko's power.
You plugged it in the power,
the docking cable, whatever they call it, the link cable.
The link cable, right? So it drew its power from that, and it was an LED that was not very powerful, and it kind of blocked your view a little bit if you were trying to look at the screen straight down on the picture. But then, you know, if you looked at a GBA screen from an angle, you couldn't see all that well. So really, like, you always had the top of the light always in your face. And I was trying to play GBA in my bed, and wow, like, this is not going to do. This doesn't work.
Yeah, it was really not meant for nighttime playing or really daytime playing, because mm-hmm. it didn't really work that great outside either. It would just get overwhelmed by the sunlight, as is often the case. But I remember the summer that it came out in 2001. I was at home working for my first summer from college. It was the only time I went home for the summer after I went to college. So it's like, it was weird because, you know, a lot of my friends didn't go home, and so there weren't as many people to hang out with, and I really felt too old for this shit, you know? Like, I was like, I'm a grown-up. I go to college. I shouldn't be living with my parents during the summer. It was just – I was – kind of I don't know, just felt really kind of out of sorts. And the GBA helped anchor me, and it actually probably kept me out of a lot of trouble because I spent most of that summer hunkered up in a very specific corner of a certain couch in the living room that made, that put me resting on the armchair right underneath a big table lamp. And there was like one very specific position I could get into, an angle that I could point that screen at where I could see it and the lamp could see it and everything was magical. And I would spend hours like cramped into this certain position because I loved playing it so much. And I would, that's how I got through Circle of the Moon and probably a lot of other GBA games.
And your and aspirant is still in that chair to this day.
Probably. We should burn that couch. It's probably long gone, actually. But I just remember, like, even in the most ideal spot I could find in the entire household, if I moved my hands like 10 degrees to either side, I completely lost it. And it would mess me up. Like, I would miss jumps and I would get killed in Castlevania because the glare would be too strong or the screen would go dark and I couldn't see what the hell was going on. So it's a serious ass problem, you know, and Nintendo figured that out pretty quickly, thankfully.
So I actually used an original GBA all the way through that system's lifespan.
Oh, bless your heart, James.
Wow. And yeah, part of it was
you are a trooper, buddy. You had, but you had the DS Fat until
I did, until John sent me an XL.
You hold in there. I mean, you hang in there, man. I mean, I remember when I got the GBA SP, that was like a life-changing event. I mean, that was I was like, "Oh my god, welcome to the next level."
Dude,
you know?
The rechargeable battery is
I was deep into the rechargeable AA's at that point. I had to be. I had an original Game Boy too until the Color came out. I needed rechargeable AA's. That thing murdered batteries. Changed batteries 30 times playing Pokemon Red. I mean, I had to. Yeah. It was just necessary.
Yeah, I just love that. I love the kind of clamshell design of the GBA SP. I just thought it was so perfect for like a portable. It was kind of thick, but it was just so good for portable thing.
Part of the reason I went to the SP was I just didn't like how it felt in my hand. I liked how the original Game Boy Advance felt in my hand. I was like, God, if they just put backlighting on this thing, I'd have been happy. And part of it was because I was a kid and didn't have any money. Yeah.
That's legit.
I got my first job towards the end of the Game Boy Advance's lifespan. I mean, that was the earliest I could start working too. I mean, I had just turned like 16 at the end of the Game Boy Advance's life. So, you know, I had to truck it out. But I did find, like Johnny said, I found places in my parents' house where it worked. There was a specific place in my bedroom that if I had the light on the ceiling fan, it worked. Or in the bathroom, if I was sitting over by the, or standing over by the sink, the lighting worked. It was like
a game unto itself.
By the sink.
It was so meta.
But like in the
it was Boktai. I mean, that's why Boktai
that's what I was thinking.
So
I was trying
funny
to think,
because
I was trying to think of the name of that game.
In a sense, it's absurd because it makes the system even more difficult to play than it already was. But also, it was almost like a meta joke on how difficult it already was to
play GBA. Go
like
play
how
the GBA
it's so
in direct
hard to find
sunlight.
The right...
Great. Yeah, this is gonna work out perfectly. You asshole.
Yeah. But it made you want to. It became part of the challenge of that game was like actually rescheduling, you know, kind of like Animal Crossing was for some people, but like rescheduling your life around this weird ass video game because you want to play it so bad.
Go fight Dracula while you can't see him. This will go great.
Yeah, I'm so embarrassed to even admit this. At my old apartment complex at college, I remember one afternoon getting to a really important boss in Boktai and walking out at probably 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the middle of summer and going to the swimming pool in our apartment complex and camping out on one of the lounge chairs there and playing my GBA because it was the only place that we had enough sunlight left to beat the boss.
So were there any people around during this episode?
No, thank God. I probably would have like turned around and walked away if they had, because I would have been too embarrassed. I just would have gone and cried myself to sleep. But
thank God, Johnny. Thank God.
This life I've led.
Yes.
The stories I could tell.
So
indeed, I'm right there with you.
Jeez, I thought I was bad having to find places in a house that it worked and not be in people's way.
Now, of course, the SP, sure, it had backlighting, but it brought on its own problem, which is it didn't have a stereo port anymore. Am I the only one that really bugged?
I thought that was kind of weird, and the fact you had to buy a little dongly thing to use headphones, I was like, that's kind of stupid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I own one of those. I actually bought it, I think, mainly for recording music for Radio Trivia. But yeah, I thought it wasn't that big of a deal to me. I thought it was regrettable that there's like anything bad at all you could say about the system, because I thought SP was miles ahead of the original every other way.
Yeah. Not in headphones. But I just, boom.
Back then, I never used headphones to play games. So I just would use the speaker, and so it wasn't a big deal to me. I just didn't care.
See, I don't know. Like Golden Sun, say what you want, it had awesome music. So yeah, I kind of missed it.
Sakuraba Strikes Again.
And I didn't want to be, you know, playing Metroid Fusion or, that game without stereo, you know, without hearing the awesome music and the ambient sounds.
For me, like, I live with people, so headphones were almost a prerequisite because a lot of the places that had proper lighting were not my bedroom. They were places I was in public. In public insofar as the other people in my home. And they probably didn't want to listen to this crap. So, I mean, that was another reason. I was like, God, why didn't they put headphones on this thing?
Yeah.
It was – I assume it was just a form factor decision, but God, it was weird. Like, it couldn't have been because they wanted to sell this stupid dongle.
No. I'm sure that thing cost them as much or more to produce and sell than they actually charged for it. Because it was like $5. You had to order it from their website. Like the labor to ship all those things out. I think it was more of a Wii Remote Jacket kind of situation where they're like, well, we kind of messed up the design of this thing and now we got to pay the price.
It's like somebody woke up, wait a minute, guys, I had a bad dream last night. We didn't put a headphone port on the SP.
Yeah.
Oh, shit!
Don't worry. Most people will never, they won't care. They'll complain, but they'll buy it anyway. And they did. So, you know, now that Virtual Console is out, I mean, they only came out today, so we haven't really had time to play much of them, but, there will be lots of time to talk about these games. But setting aside Virtual Console specifically, what are some of our favorite games? And maybe one way to look at it is, what would you most love to be released on Virtual Console now? What would you love to go back and play now? Whether or not it's even in the realm of possibility.
Wow. I think that I'm a little bit more down on overall, like the GBA library overall, because there's a lot of ports and there's a lot of remakes. The GBA was one of the only portables of Nintendo's that didn't have an original Mario, and I think that really hurt it. And, you know, like Kirby, there was Nightmare in Dreamland, which was a remake. There were the Donkey Kong Country games. Those were remakes. I had to turn to third parties for a lot of original platformers, and I'm not sure if they're ever going to come out on the Virtual Console. So that saddens me, but Rayman 3 was really, really good. It was an original 2D platformer. It's much better than the original Rayman game, in my opinion. And there's also the Klonoa games, which were pretty cool. They were more puzzle-oriented than I think the original PlayStation game or the Wii remake that we got. They were more about, okay, how do you use these enemies that you can use to propel yourself upwards? How can you use them to get through these levels? And they were pretty cool.
Well, I mean, a couple for me, I would love to see Drill Dozer. That's a really kind of cool little game. Even though, you know, one of the things that kind of had the Rumble cartridge, if I remember correctly.
You know, now that M2 is doing the emulators for GBA Virtual Console, maybe they will make your Wii U controller rumble when it would have in the original game. Since that was an add-on, that might be something they might be able to kind of fake, you know. And I could see them doing it. I think those guys care enough to support things like that. I think Drill Dozer is a great game. It's awesome. It would be a fantastic Virtual Console release.
I'd also like to say, one I've brought up before is Scourge Hive, one of my favorite kind of little games.
That was really, really late in the GBA's release. In fact, I think it was like cross-platform. It also came out on DS.
Yeah, it did.
Yes. And the DS version's a little better, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you know, I remember reading IGN, and Craig Harris was saying the GBA version is better. The DS version has the map, so that's useful, but the GBA version had more effects going on, ironically. Like, the DS couldn't handle some of the effects.
Yeah, maybe some of the scaling, I'm not sure. Because they do, like sprite scaling.
But yeah, that's a fun game, because it's kind of an isometric Metroid game. In a way.
Kind of. Yeah. It's very action-y. Lots of shooting. I had the DS version, so maybe I'm just partial to it, but I like that game quite a bit. I was going to throw down Astro Boy.
Yeah.
That's a good one from Treasure.
Astro Boy Omega Factor is really good.
It's licensed, but that's got to be a not an expensive license if you wanted to drag that back up. I mean, that game is so highly regarded.
Yeah, it's so amazing. You play through it the first time, and you know, you finish it very quickly. You're wondering what the hell is going on, you know? Like, the game can't be this short. And then you realize that there's all these characters hidden through the levels that you have to rescue. And every time that you get one, you can power up one of your abilities. And also, you get a different ending. I had tons of fun with that game. It kind of came out, I don't know. I don't know if they came out at the same time, but I was playing it basically concurrently with Beautiful Joe. And that was just like a 1-2 punch of awesome 2D action games. It was it was pretty great.
It's pretty hot shit. Yeah, I really like Astro Boy.
Well, I mean, Astro Boy was Treasure, and Treasure also worked on Advanced Guardian Heroes for GBA.
Yep.
Which was right. I never played
pretty
that.
Good as well.
Thanks for just making me have to find that on my list and take it off, John.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I played Advanced Guardian Heroes, but I did not play Astro Boy, and that's kind of the one that got away from me.
They
for
also
GBA.
Made Gunstar Superheroes,
right?
Yes,
I think that's most people think that's really not nearly as good as the original Genesis game, but I'd still like to play it. I played a demo at E3 once, but I'd never played the original at that point, so I didn't know what the hell was going on.
I enjoyed especially Superheroes quite a bit. That was a very late game, though. That was, I want to say that was late 2005.
Yeah, well, you remember for a long time, Treasure had a policy of no sequels.
Right.
And they finally broke that, and Gunstar Superheroes might have been the very first one.
I believe it was.
It was a big deal because they had tried to make a couple of 3D games on PlayStation 2, and they had not gone so well. So everybody was really excited for, and they made that GameCube game too, the Wario World. But everybody was so excited for them to go back to 2D and especially to go and revisit these beloved franchises and turn them into franchises. That was a really big deal. I mean, I remember when Square jumped on also very late. You know, remember they had the weird deal where they created a new company jointly with Yamauchi. And no, it wasn't that one. It was called Game Development Company or something like that. It was like a super, like, really generic. It was a holding company, and the rumor was that it was some kind of legal wrangling to get around Square's deal with Sony, because they were partially owned by Sony at that point. But the, you know, the people in charge of Square, again, this was before Square Enix, I think. They really wanted to release games on GBA, and Nintendo's like, well, we'll let you make games for GBA if you also make us a Final Fantasy for GameCube. And that's how we got the Bucket.
Yeah.
All right.
Which I don't, I resent that game being referred to as the Bucket, because that game's amazing.
It is great. No, it is. But they, but what they really cared about was like doing Final Fantasy stuff on GBA, and they did, and it was really good.
I beat that game single player. You know how hard that is? You know how fucking hard that is? The game's impossible single player.
It doesn't even sound fun to me.
It was fun actually, up until the boss. Then it was miserable.
I think it's a foregone conclusion that we're going to get WarioWare on the VC.
But see, here's
but
the thing.
I think that there's nothing really preventing them technologically from doing Twisted as well.
Twisted is the only one that matters. Just be clear.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, WarioWare on the original WarioWare on Game Boy Advance was a revelation.
Yes.
WarioWare Twisted is a masterpiece of insane individuals who probably should be kept from making video games.
No, it's also, to me, more fun and controls better and just felt more like a real game. The first one felt like an experiment to me, like a really interesting, funny one, but Twisted to me felt like, oh, this is an awesome series. Like, to me, it was a huge
out
step
of that,
up.
Personally, like, I get different experiences from them, so I enjoy them in different ways. But I mean, I would love to get the first one because I think it's a great game.
So, James, I know you've got a whole list here. Why don't you run us through a few of them?
Sure. We've already spoken about Golden Sun. I actually prefer the sequel more, but
I've never played it.
We don't talk about the third game, which I reviewed.
Yeah, I was kind of burnt out on the sequel by the time.
We don't talk about the third game.
Well, I can tell you, after playing the first game, there's only so many ... I can handle characters saying.
The thing about the second game that I really liked is how it's the first RPG I played where it explicitly leaves you with the cliffhanger. And the second game, it just picks it right back up. You're like, all right, we're back. Let's do this.
Yeah, like they're literally back-to-back games.
Like, I really liked that about it. It was like, okay, and I got to wait a year to find out what happens to these idiots.
I was like, Golden Sun, you got Moxie. I like that.
Yeah, kid. You're going to take him out. Remember, swing when he's not looking.
Kid, you're going to go far.
Get through the list.
So I'll start with the game that I like that I'm probably the only person who played and probably the only person who likes. Which is Lufia Ruins of Lore, which is the last Lufia game I liked before the Darkening happens.
No, that's
kind
not
of
a
the
remake.
Gaiden, right?
Yeah, this is a Gaiden. It was a Stopless Gaiden in Japan. Okay. Stopless is the series name.
So not a true sequel to Lufia, but
no, it's not
another Lufia game.
Yeah, we never even got the Lufia games on the Virtual Console.
It was a weird one. So it was developed by Atelier Double. Which, as far as I know, is the only game they ever made, and published by Taito in Japan, and published by Atlas here. So the odds of it coming out are literally less than zero. I mean, it would be
negative.
I mean, you're dealing with a company that doesn't exist anymore, a company that is wholly owned by a company that's completely incompetent, and a company that's wholly owned by Square Enix. So yeah, have fun. Have fun with that license. Like I said, I like the Golden Sun and the Lost Age quite a bit. I really enjoy Fire Emblem, the original game, which you've already got on the Master Program. The original Game Boy Advance game. It's like I have the enduring memory of just seeing Hector go all straight badass in this really fluid animation of jumping in the air and slamming an axe down on a Riven Rider's head. It's like once that happened in the game, I'm like, all right, game, you got me. You win. I'm here for the ride. Let's do this.
So did you get into Rhythm Heaven back then, or was
holy
that not until
the shit,
DS
I got
game?
Into Rhythm Heaven back then.
So it was an import, but it was a pretty widely known import.
I bought it in the store, let's put it that way. I was able to walk into a store and buy the game.
Yeah. I mean, this is in the age of the internet. You can't release a game in Japan and keep it a secret.
Yeah.
So when Awesome Games didn't come out to the West, people went out and found them out. This was the first time I'd ever imported a game, was for GBA. And it was easy because there's no region lock.
Yeah, and Rhythm Heaven. I mean, there's some text in there where there's like extra jokes that you may miss, but yeah, I mean that game easy import. And I walked into a store and dropped, I don't know, $35 for it and walked out, which tells you how many they imported in that batch. That the shipping costs were low enough that I could buy it for $35 when it probably retailed for about $30 in Japan.
Oh, probably more than that. But yeah, I mean, I remember playing, I probably still have a copy around here of Mega Man Zero in Japanese. And that's another really good kind of sub-series.
So that was one I was going to mention. So for me, it's 03 is the one that I fetishize quite a bit.
It's pretty hot
shit. But that whole series is unfucking believable.
Yeah, the first one's a little rough in terms of the structure. There's a lot of weird menus and stuff, which was tough for me again.
And four goes all open world, and it's kind of janked.
I like four, but two and three are really tight, really polished.
So when the DS port came out, I remember talking about it on the show. I want to say I beat the whole collection between episodes and came back, and I'm like, oh, Mega Man Zero, oh my god, what's going on? like these games, I remember. So I remember asking for Mega Man Zero for Christmas because, again, I was a kid. I didn't have any money. Yeah. And they bought me instead Mega Man Battle Network 2, which
– not a bad game.
No, awesome. I actually love that game. I really enjoyed it. It's goofy. It's ridiculous. It's got that weird kind of stupid anime story that I kind of love because it's so silly and so ridiculous and so dumb and just wonderful and upbeat and positive. And I have to get into the internet port on the dam because it's about to explode. So I'm going to jack my robot in there. We're going to go nuts. I love it. I love that game. And
That series, the Battle Network series, I think came out at a perfect time when Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon were two of the hottest cartoons. And And it was, everybody was ready for that stuff. And those became, I think they were probably the most popular Mega Man games released up to that point. Because, you know, the originals released, had never been like huge sellers. Right. They just had a really devoted fan base.
They released like four of them. And yeah. I think they got into the two color mode crap at some point. But I just
it's like two different versions.
Yeah, I liked the mix of the strategy and the collecting that you had to do. So you had to collect these chips and then you had to figure out what to do strategy wise to use them. And Wikipedia is telling me there's six Mega Man Battle Network games. It's basically want to throw my laptop into the ground.
I think one of them actually has three different versions that came out.
God damn,
and that is
Capcom.
Battle Network is a spinoff of Mega Man that has its own spinoff.
It does have Mega Man
Star
Force.
There's also the Battle Chip Collector.
Oh,
and yeah, the Star Force games were the DS continuation. They're kind of like the new gen of that. And there was also the 2D action platformer released for GameCube, which is weird.
Mega Man Command Mission.
It's okay. Well, that Command Mission is the RPG. That's
NT Warrior. Is that it? No.
No, it's called Network Transmission.
That's it. Yeah. God damn, these names don't make any sense. Transmission, I am not a fan of. Command Mission, I honestly wanted to hurt somebody while I was playing it.
Yeah, I always heard Command Mission. That's a Mega Man X RPG.
If you like bad games, Command Mission will amuse you for about an hour.
I wanted it to be good so bad.
It's so bad, so bad.
Yeah.
But for me, I played that game, and then I went back and played one. One is real raw. Two is really good, and then I played three, and three is pretty good. I think two is really where that series is at its best. Then I just ran roughshod over the Zero games, and then by then it was time for the one game that I probably haven't mentioned. I'm surprised nobody's brought up yet: Final Fantasy Tactics Advance. Or I don't care if you're a cripple in real life; I'm taking you out of this fantasy world. Oh, and I'm the good guy. It's my favorite part of that game is you play as the guy who's ruining everybody's good time, and that makes you the hero. Thanks, game.
I didn't bring that game up because I don't like it very much.
Oh, I love that game.
I think it's a pale shadow of the PlayStation original. But
maybe. But I enjoyed playing it quite a bit. I think it's well put together. I think I like the fact
it looks great. I'll say
I
that.
Just
I
like
think
the fact that the story
it's fantastic.
Is so. I think gameplay-wise, I mean, I think all these games pale in comparison to my personal choice for that particular style of game. So it's a moot point to me that this one's not as good as its predecessor.
Yeah.
But I just find that game has this weird charm to it. And I think part of it is the fact that the story is so stupid that it's just really enjoyable. Like, I mean, it's a fun game. The mechanics work. The gameplay works. It's beautiful. There's all these different races that you can get involved, have in your party, and different classes you can play with. And yeah, ultimately, the whole plot is it's basically some kid's imagination. And that's that's kind of a fun thing. I kind of enjoy it. It's the only thing I hate about that game is the laws. Which, to an extent, the laws are the biggest pain in the ass I've ever seen in a game. And if you don't remember what those are, basically, these things called judges would show up before a battle and be like, you can't use swords in this mission. And you look at your party and go, oh, shit. Or they would just, I mean, it was totally random. And later in the game, you could introduce your own laws and just completely break the game. I had a law where no one was allowed to hurt anybody. I had played all the law cards, so neither party could hurt one another. So everybody just walked around the stage and nobody could do anything. It was
that is so dumb.
So
broken.
It's so broken, yeah. And I loved it. I mean, I played that mission for like 10 minutes trying to figure out how am I going to play a law card to fix this, because I couldn't attack him. So I'm like, well, I'll play mine since he can't attack me either. There, now I'm going to figure it out. I loved it. It was dumb and amazing. So for me, that game was, I mean, I spent, I don't know, 30 hours in that game. I really enjoyed it. And then, of course, Minish Cap. Which is
How has that not come up already?
Minish Cap is the
too obvious. That's why
is the most beautiful game on Game Boy Advance, bar none.
There is no
game on Game Boy Advance that comes within 100 miles of how good that game looks.
And yeah, it's fantastic.
It's the things it does with scale, with perspective. I mean, the game feels like a 3D game, and how well it uses perspective and layering, and just the effects of having things in the foreground, the background, and just how it blends these big, huge sprites that have to be drawn when Link is a tiny little Minish. And it still manages to keep this really high-fidelity artwork on. I mean, the Game Boy Advance screen's not that high fidelity. Mm-hmm. It is a marvel in so many ways that for me it is maybe my second favorite 2D Zelda game. And yeah. I mean that's kind of nuts because Capcom made that game.
Yeah, I mean, right. But it was really good. I mean, it was kind of like the best of both worlds at the time, really.
It's unbelievable. It really is.
I was just recently thinking about Minish Cap. I was going through all the Ambassador games thinking, like, how many of those did I even play? And there were some that I thought maybe I would go back and play, and Minish Cap was one of them, but I didn't. And so now I'm thinking, I haven't played Minish Cap since it came out. I probably burned through that game in 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
Bought it the day it released, and I probably haven't touched it since then. And, like, I'm thinking, I really want to go back and play more of that. I don't even remember that much about it, except that I really liked it a lot.
The flagship Zelda games really annoy me just with their collectathon aspects. And I just can't get over, like, the whole, what was it, like, the friendship medallions or whatever it was.
You don't have to use them.
Yeah, but they're there and they annoy me. Like, the NPCs, that's all they talk about, no?
I'm going to drop a game that I'm sure we can all agree on, except James. Castlevania Aria of Sorrow is one of my favorite games of all time.
It's really good. Yep.
It's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I like the sequel, Dawn of Sorrow, but Aria of Sorrow did everything that game did better and first. So they just had a cool concept with a whole, you take the enemy's souls and that turns into weapons. Just the layout of the castle seemed to make more sense in this game than in other Castlevania Zelda games.
Yes.
Very snappy. You're done in about, like, I don't know, like 10, 12 hours, but it's just so great from the beginning to the end.
Well, it was the third Castlevania game they had released on that system in 3 years. Mm-hmm. That game was out in 2003 because I was playing it through most of my trip to Russia that summer. So I know that was out in the summer of 2003, which would have been 2 years after the release of Circle of the Moon. So three games in 3 years, these guys, Igarashi, knew exactly how to make that GBA sing. And that game looks absolutely incredible. It has fantastic music. It plays, I think, just about perfectly for the kind of game that it is. It is executed on every level. And it's not trying any gimmicky shit, which was a problem on the DS games. So I think Aria of Sorrow is just maybe my favorite Castlevania game of all of them. For me, it was the game where it was no longer about trying to make a portable game that was as good as Symphony of the Night. I thought it was much better. And I think it holds up now if you go back and play it. So that one actually might come out on Virtual Console, and I'm excited for it because I can always use an excuse to go back and beat it for the seventh time or whatever it is. And I would love for a lot of other people to play it who might have missed it back then because it is brilliant. It's incredible. I
mean, really, all three of those GBA Castlevania games are really, really good. I mean,
they're all worth playing, yeah.
Yeah, they are. They are.
I'm not personally a fan of these games, but I know the Advance Wars games on the GBA are more well-regarded than the DS ones.
Yes. I only played the first one, but I loved it. That one is out today, and I've considered, because that was not one of the Ambassador games, so I considered buying it.
I still have the cart, but it's a little bit, I don't know, I like Advance Wars better than Fire Emblem, if simply because Advance Wars, I get a little bit better. It's a little bit easier also because the AI is so easy to fool. And your units are disposable, so you just send a weak unit to draw the computer in, and then you can unleash hell, and it's pretty damn satisfying.
And it's more about resource management because you can produce, I mean, you can overwhelm an enemy also. There's a total unit count on the field, but that's really a technical limitation. Right. But you can definitely, like, kind of swarm people. And so it's a fairly easy strategy to abuse, and it's a way to make the game less frustrating.
And that's why those games never did it for me personally.
It makes it feel a little more action-y, I think. Like, it's not real time, it's still turn-based, but it's faster paced than Fire Emblem. And I don't sit there and worry about, should I reset the mission if I lose a unit? Well, of course I shouldn't. I'll make another one. And so the game feels more progressive. It feels like you're just moving through the missions a lot faster than you are in Fire Emblem. It's definitely less contemplative. It feels more like a board game, you know? And I thought it was great.
And a very welcoming board game because You know, you think about strategy games, you think, you think of PC games, you think, okay, a lot of menus and, you know, serious shit. But in this game, it's just, war is fun. Let's have a war, because, you know, it's super fun and dynamic and shit blows up and we're just having an awesome time.
Let's just have a good time and blow some shit up.
Let's just do it. Let's just get this up. Well, I mean, speaking of having a good time and blow things up, I'm trying to think about games I have played on GBA, and I've got one that I think John will really appreciate. The GBA port of Altered Beast.
No.
It's so delicious.
So, I don't want to talk about this bad game anymore, but I do want to talk about these ports, because Guillaume
brought
it up.
That's kind of why I brought
it
up.
Yeah, I mean, there were tons of these. I don't want to fixate on one of the worst, but...
It's not GBA, one of the worst!
Okay, but not a good one. GBA had so many ports of old things, and you know, it was a chance for me to go back and play through Breath of Fire 2 and some other games from the Super Nintendo era that I really liked and was happy to buy again. And I think back and I'm thinking, I probably spent $30 on Breath of Fire 2, a game that I had already played a ton of on Super Nintendo not that many years earlier.
That's $30 well spent.
Well,
It's
crazy to think back, because now I can download that on Wii U for $8. And you know, this was before Virtual Console. And at the time, I feel like GBA was a kind of a brand new world of ports. And there were some, you know, complaints about it because there were so many, and people thinking, well, they're really diluting this system by releasing so many games from other systems on it. There's not enough original content. I think in the end there was enough original content, but sometimes the number of Super Nintendo and PS1 and Game Boy Color upgrades and weird stuff like that was a little bit overwhelming. And then Nintendo did the NES Classics series or Famicom Classics, and now they're selling literally like Donkey Kong for NES, not even a good version of that game, for $25. What was it? I mean,
it was on a gray cartridge. Mm-hmm. It was on a gray cartridge.
Yeah, it was like they were almost. It was almost like they weren't even trying to hide the fact that it was a bad value, but they were amping up the collector's aspect so much that people went crazy for it.
And that was about the same time they put out the NES colored Game Boy Advance SP.
Yes,
they had that,
I remember
they had that,
that
one that was gray with the black stripes and the red buttons.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that came out at the same time.
Oh, it was transparent marketing all over the place.
Yeah, I think for the first time, Nintendo was getting like really into mining the nostalgia for its games, and it was working. I couldn't believe those games sold the way they did. It was like, guys,
they sold really well.
There are really good new GBA games for the same price that you could be playing. And obviously they'd hit on something, and I think that's part of what led to them doing Virtual Console a few years later on the Wii, because they were like, there's a market for this, guys.
I wasn't even aware that there was that they were selling so well in North America. I thought it was
mostly in Japan. Well.
They were a big hit. Yeah,
crazy. I mean, that's why they drove
me nuts. In Japan, they did the collector thing way better, because the cartridges came in mini boxes, like miniature versions of the Famicom boxes.
What's kind of telling is, if you were looking at a list of games released on the GBA, which I'm doing because I didn't prepare for this segment because I never do that, is all the games that lead with Super in the name. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a telling sign right there.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, yeah, that's port. And sometimes the Super became so ubiquitous, they threw Super on there even when it wasn't a port.
Like Gunstar Superheroes, yeah.
It's like, well, Super's just part of the game, so we put it on there. It's like no, you're on the wrong system, what are you doing? And it's just, it just became such a thing that it happened.
Mario Kart Super Circuit.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah. Not the best Mario Kart game, but it has its fans.
Oh god, I played a lot of weird GBA RPGs now that they're coming back to me. Oh man.
Well, before we go, one game that I really have to talk about, some people will groan about this, but Metroid Zero Mission, also one of my favorite games of all time. on the GBA. And you know, this was the whole system was a great, it was a great time to be a Metroid fan back in the early 2000s. But, yeah. Zero Mission was my favorite of the whole batch. And I thought it was, I mean, it came out, I think almost to the day, 1 year after Fusion, and it is better in every conceivable way. It is a spectacular game. And, and I love Fusion too. Don't get me wrong. I think, it's very much worth playing, but Zero Mission is sublime. It is unbelievably good.
Yeah, it's a great game.
I'm more of a Fusion fan myself. The whole non-linearity of Zero Mission was, it felt a little bit too forced for me. Like, oh, you'll get like 12 different endings if you do these things in different order. I don't know. I didn't really appreciate it. And Fusion, I liked the just the urgency of Samus's mission. And I kind of liked the linearity, to be honest. Perhaps not like where they literally blocked off every other path, you know, but the one you had to take, that was a little bit much. But no, I don't know. Fusion had a great story and really cool power-ups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fusion's more exciting because it is all new content and new powers and, you know, new character designs. And just that world has a different feel to it than other Metroid games. But for me, Zero Mission is just polished to the extreme. It is, it plays so much faster, you know, and it basically is like, hey, the original Metroid barely functions on NES. What if we remade that in the style of Super Metroid, but with our Fusion engine? And you end up getting kind of the best of all the worlds of 2D Metroid, and it's my favorite one. So I've played that one so many times. But anyway, so guys, any last words on GBA before we wrap it up? Any kind of final thoughts, or would anyone like to summarize how this system lives in your memory in the long chain of Nintendo platforms over the years?
So I made the reference earlier that it had an incredibly short life. And I mean, it's 4 or 5 years, roughly.
Five is a stretch, but they were dense with releases and hardware revisions.
Yeah, I mean, and there were some games leaking out well into the DS lifespan, but it's a weird system for me because of the games I've played on it. Were all, you know, they tended to be real long JRPGs and stuff like Summon Knight, real niche stuff. So my GBA experience is incredibly different than everyone else's that I know. But that's kind of reveals something about that system. It was such a short lifespan, but you were able to have incredibly different experience than the person next to you had with the same system. So it allows it to sort of live on as a personal, you know, you can write your own little personal epitaph for its very short life and sort of remember it the way you choose. I don't think there's another system like that. I mean, there are systems like the PS2 that have lots of games in diverse categories. You can obviously have your own experience, but they lived much longer than this one. And it's so weird to see a system come in and go away so quickly and yet offer such a wide diversity of gameplay that you could develop your own library all your own.
I think also it was kind of a decentralized library in the sense that there weren't one or two iconic games that everybody had, you know, which was often the case with Nintendo platforms. Everyone had Mario 64. Everybody had it.
Right.
And there's nothing like that on GBA. So people did kind of go off into their own play styles or their own interests within this very broad library. And I mean, I was just thinking that there are probably people for whom GBA was almost exclusively a Pokemon device, and we haven't even mentioned those games. So
they're the worst Pokemon games.
Yeah, but for, you know, if those were your first, then, you know,
I'm sorry. the GBA ones are the worst. I mean, it's not even close.
Okay, but they're out there.
Nobody goes, oh man, I love Emerald.
I don't have that high of an opinion of the GBA. I think that the DS pretty much trounced it in every way. And also, it kind of came out at the time I was a student, so I financed buying new GBA games by, you know, trading in the old ones. So there's not a lot in my collection that remains. So I've forgotten a lot of the games that I've played, so maybe that skews my perception a bit. But I did enjoy, you know, getting more 2D platformers. That was a novelty back then. There was no other way to get them. You couldn't get them on,
you know, any of the current systems, and it was just great to be playing, as I mentioned, Klonoa and Rayman 3, and I wish that Nintendo had made more platformers, but eventually they did, so I'm happy about that. But the DS replaced it. A lot of the firsts that the GBA did, like, first Advance Wars that we got here, or first Mario and Luigi game, kind of got driven into the ground since then. But back then, like, they were really special. Mario and Luigi in particular, it was just so hilarious. It was finally the Mario RPGs are back, and the dialogue was, actually laugh out loud funny. And they've made four of them since then, but, you know, the original, in my opinion, is still the best.
Yeah, I'm probably going to be talking about that game next week because I bought it today, but I haven't started playing it yet. But Mario and Luigi, at the time, I remember thinking somehow Nintendo had snuck into being maybe the best localization company, you know, publisher in the world. Or, I mean, in America, at least. You know, of all the companies releasing games, I was like, I never would have put Nintendo at the top of, like, making the most interestingly written games. But yeah. I felt with Mario and Luigi, they just out of nowhere, they're like, it was incredible, you know, and I'm really excited to go back and read that stuff again. Cause I remember thinking it was so fantastically good at the time. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. I'm looking at your review. You gave it a 9.5 Superstar Saga.
I like that game.
Yeah. A little bit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, for me, the GBA was interesting. I mean, again, very brief lifespan. To me, it was kind of a buildup to the DS, really. It seemed almost experimental in a lot of ways with, you know, Nintendo kind of playing around with form factors. Really, I think the first GBA, they just tried to get it out on the market as quickly as they could, obviously because of the screen issues and all that. Yeah, it was just interesting. It seemed disposable.
But why?
Almost.
What would they have been trying to get out in front of?
I don't know. But it just seemed like they were just kind of trying to evolve their handhelds past Game Boy. I mean, it's just this was kind of a period of sort of where Nintendo wasn't really afraid to put out disposable handhelds, it seemed. The Game Boy Color came out, and that was out for pretty much a cup of coffee before it was tossed to the side. GBA comes out. They go through several iterations. They bring out the GBA SP. They bring out the GBA Micro and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, you kind of saw that extended with the DS. I think, the start. I mean, the Game Boy Color was really the start, but, you saw the Nintendo putting out, you know, really being willing to revise their hardware. This is really where it kind of kicked into full gear, I thought. So, really good, really short lifespan, had some great games, but, you know, it was kind of like just shoved aside for the DS, and it was sort of, you know, DS took off from there.
Well, it's getting another chance of glory before it once again gets usurped by the DS on Virtual Console. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad people are going to get to check it out, and I know we will be. So looking forward to seeing what comes out. It's a really good launch lineup on Virtual Console, and the stuff in Japan is promising as well. And if we end up getting a subset of those, I'll be pretty happy. There's a lot of interesting directions they could take it, especially if some of the, you know, third parties that still exist, like Konami and Capcom, get involved with it. There's a lot of promise there. So anyway, that's going to have to wrap up our feature. I hope everybody enjoyed taking a stroll back to the GBA era. We are probably going to get back to emails next week. I think it'll probably be at least the episode after that before we do retroactive with GoldenEye, because we still need more time to play it. So next week we'll probably do emails. Send yours in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. There's a lot to talk about, and we would love to hear from you and hear what you'd like to hear us talk about on the show. So please do send us a letter, and please do play GoldenEye with us. There is a forum thread on our website where you can exchange friend codes. Unfortunately, that's necessary, but it's worth it. The game is really, really fun, and the whole point is to play online with each other. So hopefully the four of us will get to knock heads a little bit online and do so with some of you guys as well. So we hope you will play with us and, post about your experiences with us and with other players and have a really good time, and we'll make it a good retroactive. So we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. But until then, we need to get in some online matches. So please go there, set it up. We'll include a link in the show notes, of course. And finally, I wanted to let people know that although we haven't even heard it yet, I think it was recorded last night, the new episode of our sister podcast, Connectivity, they did an interview with Jules Watcham from Renegade Kid about their new Kickstarter campaign for Colt County, which is a first-person survival horror shooter game in the mold of Dementium, which are really cool DS first-person horror games. And this one was originally coming to 3DS, and some of us played it last year at PAX East on 3DS. It was a tech demo.
It was just like a house and blowing sand, and you couldn't do anything.
You walked around with a wrench and could hit the wall and make noises. Yeah.
Understood. It was a very limited tech demo. It was very impressive, though. They are actually turning that into a console and PC game, and it's headed to Wii U if it gets funded. So Jules is a really fun guy. We've met him before and talked to him, so I think you'll enjoy listening to him talk about that game, and maybe you'll be interested in backing it. So check that out on Connectivity. And that's it, folks. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back next week with more Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.